Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to the New Books in German Studies podcast. My name is Darren O'Byrne, and today I'm joined in person by Wolfgang Zeibel, Professor of Politics and Public Administration at Konstanz University and Adjunct Professor of Public Administration at the Hertie School of Governance here in Berlin. He's written and edited numerous books, including Verwaltung verstehen, or in English, Understanding Administration, and Der prekäre Staat, Herrschen und Verwalten im Nationalsozialismus, in English, The Precarious or Uncertain State, Governance and Administration under National Socialism. But he's joined me today to talk about what I think is his latest book to be translated into English. Is that correct? Yeah. And it's called Persecution and Rescue, The Politics of the Final Solution, 1940 to 1944, published last year with the University of Michigan Press. Professor Zeibel, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start with you first, if I can. Could you maybe tell our listeners a little bit about you and your career and how your interest in public administration informed your approach to this book?
Well, I'm a political scientist by training, and I developed an interest in public administration, well, necessarily many years ago, because there's a famous saying of old German sociologist Max Weber, who said at one point, well, in everyday life, to rule means one thing, and that's administration. So as a political scientist, I was always interested in how, well, the organization of power functions, and public administration is inevitably and, well, part and parcel, as they say, of mobilization of power and how power is being used and being mobilized and being constrained at the same time.
The book's subtitle is The Politics of the Final Solution in France, 1940 to 1944. And I want to start at the beginning, if I may. Germany has just defeated France in the summer of 1940, and the country is partitioned into different zones of occupation. Could you maybe explain how and why this comes about, and maybe who is occupying where?
Well, the thing is that even for the German military and even for Hitler himself, sudden and quick defeat of France came as a surprise. And these people still had in mind the Great War and the war in the trenches that had stretched over 4 years. So the mindset, as far as we know, was now what counted was to preserve stability and to neutralize France as an ally of the United Kingdom in an ongoing war. And that was the main objective. And as a result of that, the armistice conditions, and the armistice was signed on June the 22nd, 1940, were relatively mild in the sense that the Germans conceded to leave a head of state in place, an entire government, and also they conceded to the French that a large part of French territory in the French mainland remained unoccupied, meaning unoccupied by German military forces, and that was the southeastern part of France. In the middle, or well, between the occupied and the unoccupied zone, was a demarcation line that was heavily guarded. And in November 1942, after the Allied, the landing of the Allied forces in Northern Africa, then the Germans also occupied the rest of mainland France. But this is in a nutshell how, in territorial terms, the occupation, the German occupation regime, was organized, and in political terms, the Germans and Hitler in person had a certain interest in keeping the French state intact, because French, after all, was an empire, and with colonies stretching from the West Indies to Southeast Asia. And the question, to what extent those colonies would remain loyal to the French government that ultimately took residence in the spa town of Vichy, which became a synonym of the French government itself. The question, how loyal the administration and the military personnel in the colonies would remain to the Vichy government, was crucial for the German war efforts as well, because, obviously, since there was a kind of alternative political force residing in London under General de Gaulle, there were split loyalties all over the place as far as French administration and the military were concerned. So having a stable, visible, and relatively strong government in place on the French mainland from the German point of view was of pivotal importance.
Just with regards to the Vichy authorities, do they have any authority whatsoever in the other zones of occupied France?
Yes. So, as a matter of fact, the division of the French mainland into two zones, the northern zone or northwestern zone that was militarily occupied by the Germans, and the southeastern zone, did not directly apply affect the French administration as such. So the Vichy authorities were in charge of running the civil administration of the entire territory of France in both the occupied and the non-occupied zone, however, with serious restrictions in the militarily occupied zone in the northwest of the country, that also included the entire coastal zone at the Atlantic, which the Germans held under military control by obvious military reasons, especially to defend the Atlantic coast against a potential landing by either the British or the Americans once the United States had entered the war in December 1941, over both of them, which turned out to be the case in June 1944.
So we've outlined the context now. The whole book is about the fate of the Jews in France. And you talk about how their fate in France, whether it be their persecution or even later on the measures taken to protect them, or at least that resulted in them not being deported, that this was guided by the quest for power within a fairly elaborate power-sharing administration comprising both German and French sides. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about the key players or institutions within this power-sharing administration, who they were, and what exactly they wanted to achieve? What was the power they were seeking to achieve?
Yeah, one has to bear in mind that France was, among the countries occupied by the Germans during the Second World War, France was a unique case. First, it was a great power, as I said, a true empire with colonies all over the place. And it was a crucial geopolitical importance, and consequently, that implied also of crucial importance for the German war efforts both in a defensive and in an offensive sense, because the economic power of France was very important, and of course the Germans made every effort to mobilize French economic power for their own war efforts. And second, it was of pivotal importance to keep France at least neutral in the ongoing war. That was more or less achieved by the armistice, whose political and administrative system was kept intact literally until the liberation of France in July and August 1944. So the power-sharing arrangement you mentioned was based on the fact that by those basic political, military, and economic objectives, the Germans had to concede competences, resources, and some sort of political discretionary leeway to the French government residing in the spa town of Vichy. And the power-sharing arrangement, in turn, implied that many things the Germans wanted to achieve in terms of political goals or in terms of economic necessities had to be negotiated with their French counterparts. And that also affected the so-called Jewish question, or to use the German euphemism of the time, the final solution of the Jewish question.
In 1940, when the Germans arrive, what is the final solution in 1940? Because it's not what it will later become.
Yeah, well, it is. I think it's common knowledge that the German plans to persecute the Jews emerged in several stages, and it was initially the plan to eliminate the Jews from German soil, and then when the war was going on in the early years of 1939 through early 1941, in terms of either forced emigration or ship hundreds of thousands or even millions of Jews to the island of Madagascar. So the so-called Madagascar plan was a transitional stage of these, if you will, master plan of anti-Jewish persecution. And it was in early 1942, on January the 20th, to be exact, of 1922, that at this infamous Wannsee conference meeting, in a villa at the outskirts of Berlin, decision was made to eliminate, to annihilate physically all the Jews under German rule in the entirety of Europe and even beyond through mass murder. And this a process of a slowly emerging but always determined and strictly planned process of how to eliminate the Jews from all the nations and societies under German control, that necessarily also affected France under German occupation.
But in the context of what's going on early on in the year 1940, when the measures being talked about for a final solution at that stage, what measures then do the French side take, the Vichy regime, to assist the German side in the pursuit of their final solution at that stage?
In order to understand that appropriately, one needs to bear in mind that the Vichy regime itself was an authoritarian right-wing regime with a very strong anti-Semitic current. And that anti-Semitism was a part of the overall political mindset of the Vichy regime. The Jews according to all the myths and legends prevalent at the time, were being made responsible for the domestic weakness of France. They were denounced as being disproportionately represented in certain professions, and they were under suspicion not to be loyal citizens, and so on and so forth. So all this was not especially French, or this was not especially unique, and did not characterize the Vichy regime or the right-wing French anti-Semitism as such. That was not originally French, but it became necessarily very influential under German occupation because the Germans had their own much more radical anti-Jewish agenda. So it was a kind of a political and ideological merger that took place once the German had invaded France and had established their occupation regime. However, the initial steps of anti-Jewish persecution took place under the Vichy authority and according to the political will of the Vichy regime alone. So the first decrees were designed to remove the Jews from certain professions or to force them to mark their shops and businesses as so-called Jewish enterprises. Those steps were taken on the Vichy initiative alone without visible, at least, German interference. Of course, the Germans and the German military authorities, including the very, well, at that time, minor and insignificant representatives of the Gestapo and the SS, they welcomed those measures. But initially, and as far as the basic impulse was concerned, those were original Vichy France initiatives.
Would you say they're in a way working towards the Führer in a way, the French authorities?
Vichy authorities or the Vichy regime, they were not in this Ian Kershaw sense working towards the Führer. They were much more working based on the notion to preserve French sovereignty and to do that in accordance with the basic ideological persuasions and, of course, political and economic interests in their own perception and in their own definition. And that was shaping also their Vichy's approach to, well, how to handle the so-called Jewish question, because it was much more about safeguarding French initiative and French competences and jurisdiction over everything that had to do with contentious areas of public service or public administration in defense against the German occupying power, much more about that than about, forming an alliance with the Germans against a common enemy such as the French. That was certainly true as far as the two ideologically motivated collaborators at the extreme right in France and in French domestic politics was concerned. But famous, well-known political scientist and historian Stanley Hoffman has put it in the 1960s already, it was about state collaboration. It was much more about a sober-minded political calculation that was driving the so-called collaboration of Vichy with the Germans rather than ideological proximity or a kind of ideologically motivated will to go after the Jews. So it was much more the original anti-Semitism with a will to remove the Jews as far as possible from certain professions and, above all, from the civil service. But there was not no parallel to the German master plan to eliminate the Jews physically.
But it is amazing that they almost preempt what the Germans want in a way that, is there any moment where the Germans arrive and they say, okay, well, now you need to do X, Y, and Z, or do the French just say, okay, this is what we need to do, and we're going to do it?
Well, that varied. There were measures of persecution, especially in the economic field, were the French authorities, the Vichy authorities, were amazingly quick in establishing regulation and legislation that restrained the economic liberty and the civil liberties of Jews, so that the Germans, in the period between the fall of 1940 and the summer of 1941, for example, probably would not have asked for more in terms of persecution measures. But the decisive threshold was the physical deportation of the Jews from French soil. So certainly it was about the legal restrictions, and it also was about the removal of Jews from any kind of significant economic activity. And that was put in place under full Vichy jurisdiction, especially the so-called Aryanization of Jewish enterprises. But the contentious issue was the physical elimination from French soil.
So if the French are willingly enacting these measures, is there at this early stage a police presence, a German police presence in France? And what are they doing? Are they just supervising what's going on, observing?
Yes, the Germans had their own occupation administration. And unlike in most of other places in German-occupied Europe, that was a military administration. And so it was basically the German Wehrmacht who was in charge of also the civil administration, or supervising rather the French civil administration. And there they had their own divisions and their own officials in charge of the persecution measures directed against the Jews as well. And it started, like I said, with the economic measures. And then it was an internal rivalry and struggle within the German occupation regime that step by step made the SS and the Gestapo more influential. And that happened, ironically enough, against the resistance of the Wehrmacht and the military administration, but ultimately, with the benefit of hindsight, you might say, well, not surprisingly, the SS and the Gestapo prevailed, and they established their own security apparatus. And it was that apparatus, under the auspices of the SS, that, according to the general pattern all over German-occupied Europe, implemented the physical elimination of the Jews, including the deportation from French soil as far as France was concerned.
And this is the topic that I want to turn to now. One of the most interesting things about the book is how you show that these institutional power struggles within this power sharing administration, as you call it, were not just between German and French sides, but that they were also power struggles within the German side and even within the French side. And how in 1942, the security police, we'll call them the SS for simplicity, how the SS, they managed to score a massive victory over the army by usurping its authority in the realm of policing. Can you maybe say a little bit about how and why that came about?
Well, the thing was that initially, meaning in the year of 1940, it was the Wehrmacht, the German military, that found itself at the peak of its prestige and influence due to this quick and dramatic military victory over France. So the military administration, in political terms, was very strong. Maybe it was strongest in France all over the place as far as German occupied territories was concerned. And they, of course, took pride in their military success. And initially, those who became the pillar and the key actors of the so-called final solution, meaning the mass murder and initially the deportation of the Jews, namely the SS, was pretty weak in France. It was just a handful of people. And, step by step, they tried to gain influence and to prop up their own security apparatus. They called it security, but in reality, of course, it was a repression apparatus. And it was both a question of operational skill and capability and political influence. And what we observe in the period between early fall 1941 and the month of April and May 1942 is a turf war between the SS and the German Wehrmacht within the German occupation regime in France. To put it in a nutshell, and to give you the brief version, resulted in the resignation of the German military commander, so the highest ranking general of the German military administration in France, Otto von Stülpnagel, that was his name, and by some old twist and irony, he was succeeded by a cousin with the same surname, also a general von Stülpnagel, whose first name was Karl Heinrich, and who was actually hanged after the failed assassination plot against Hitler in July 1944. So he was anything but a typical Nazi. But in the course of that turf war, the SS had gained strength and power, and the formal indicator for that was the establishment of the position of a so-called higher SS and police commander, or in German it is Höhere SS and Polizeiführer, that had not existed before in France, but was otherwise the usual regional instance of the SS apparatus. And the general expectation, and the quite natural expectation also among the other branches and divisions of the occupation administration, the German occupation administration in France, was that now had come the time where the military would be sidelined, and that especially the persecution of the Jews would be radicalized, and it was necessarily also the expectation the rank and file officials of the SS and the Gestapo themselves held back then. But the interesting thing is that the SS turned out to be much more diplomatic and much more flexible in terms of its own political agenda that was pursued in France than expected.
So just to clarify, this power grab on behalf of the SS. It came on the back of a hostage crisis.
Yes.
And they used this as a catalyst to seize power from the Wehrmacht, who have been accused of not pursuing this harsh enough, for not being radical enough in their pursuit of this problem. Do the SS then kill more hostages than the Wehrmacht had?
No, the irony is the opposite came true. And it was, brutal and mere cynicism that initially, meaning after the German invasion of Soviet Russia in June and the subsequent acts of sabotage committed mainly but not exclusively by communists and in France, and the German both anti-communist and anti-Jewish propaganda in the context of that, the so-called hostage crisis emerged out of the fact that the German military administration in France took hostages. And under the pressure, sometimes from Hitler in person, they executed summarily 50 or 100 Frenchmen that had taken hostage for one German soldier or otherwise a member of the German occupation administration in response to assassinations or attacks on German military personnel or military institutions. And that created a very difficult and awkward situation for the Vichy regime, because it was clearly against any kind of national, especially right-wing and conservative nationalist feeling that the occupying power was executing so many Frenchmen in exchange or in response to acts of resistance, even if those were communist or including the Vichy propaganda, Jews and communists. That was, by the way, the same language that was used by the Vichy propaganda, very similar to the German propaganda back then. Nonetheless, the fact that so many Frenchmen died at the hand of the German occupation power created or undermined the authority of the Vichy government. And that was what the high-ranking military representatives of the occupation regime tried desperately to make clear to the authorities in Berlin. But that was sabotaged by the SS, especially by Reinhard Heydrich, who was the strongman of the SS and a man with very determined career ambitions. He not mitigated the erupting crisis as far as the smooth collaboration between the German and French authorities was concerned, but he escalated the crisis, and he did that for one purpose only, which was gaining power at the expenses of the German military, the military administration in France. And he ultimately succeeded in those efforts.
Now, we've sort of outlined the contours of what each side in this wanted to achieve. For the French, it was autonomy, and for the SS, it was power. The sort of the dimensions change, however, after 1942, because whereas before 1942, the mass murder of the Jews tended to proceed locally, more or less, afterwards we begin to see the emergence of a general plan to murder all Jews in their entirety. And with that, there are increasing demands placed by the security services in France on the French side to deliver Jews for deportation. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about how far the French side were willing to go in this regard? I mean, were they willing to give up Jews just the same amount of Jews that the Germans required, or were they a little bit more reserved?
Yeah, they were reserved, especially as far as one issue was concerned, and that was the potential deportation of Jews of French citizenship. That for the Vichy, even for the Vichy authority, was a question of principle. While they conceded, after some kind of arduous negotiations, one has to say, to have all the non-French Jews deported, including Jews that had fled to France in the hope to find refuge there. So they handed them over to the Germans, and they did that, of course, in accordance with the German deportation scheme. But initially, meaning from mid-July on, those deportation plans were carried out according to what had been agreed upon at the Wannsee Conference. And it was, from the German perspective, a first achievement, especially, of course, achievement of the SS and the Gestapo, that also from French soil, the Jews were being deported, and they were deported, as a matter of fact, directly to Auschwitz, almost all of them, where they were, again, almost all of them murdered on the spot upon arrival in the gas chambers.
Perhaps the most visible product of German-French cooperation after the emergence of this general plan to murder all of the Jews was the Oberg-Bosque Agreement of August 1942. Can you tell us briefly about what that was?
Yes. So the what is called the Oberg-Bosque Accord or Agreement was signed on August the 8th, 1942. And it was a very general and comprehensive agreement about all police matters in cooperation or collaboration between the Germans and the Vichy government. And that included, among other things, concession of the Vichy government to hand over to the Germans enemies of the Reich, that was the language in use. And that again included the Jews as far as they were not French Jews. So that was basically the follow-up agreement to what had been agreed upon earlier, roughly 6 weeks earlier, between Bousquet, and Bousquet was René Bousquet, the Secretary General of the French police on the one hand, and his German counterpart as far as the SS and Gestapo was concerned, Karl Oberg. And that's where the name comes from, the Oberg-Bousquet Accord or Agreement. But the decisive point as far as the fate of the Jews was concerned, that it was, the official seal, if you will, on an agreement that served, as far as German interests were concerned, the purpose to having the legal, quasi-legal, or at least official consent of the French side to have the non-French Jews, for the time being, deported from French soil.
So deportations are beginning in earnest. They're probably not going at the rate that many within the SS would like them to. And then something really significant happens, and the Catholic Church begins to speak out, if you will, against the deportations. And this really, really affects the French side's ability to mm-hmm. proceed with the deportations. Can you tell us why the church spoke out when it did, and what effect it did actually have on the French side?
Yeah, this is certainly the decisive period. So the time between second half of July and early September 1942, because the mass deportations started in mid-July, And they were accompanied by a scenery of atrocities, of inhuman treatment of just ordinary people, also in the perception of the bystanders. So herding people together, including women and children, putting them in a place like the Velodrome at Hiver under catastrophic conditions as far as hygiene and other things were concerned. Perception, the public opinion was that this is a typical act of an aggressive occupying power, regardless what ever French anti-Semitism could have been or would be, regardless, by the way, of the fact that many Frenchmen had been passive as far as Vichy's own anti-Jewish legislation and measures were concerned, regardless of the fact that also the Catholic Church had been very passive as far as Vichy's own anti-Jewish legislation was concerned. That was a turning point in the sense that it was the first time that the brutality and the ruthlessness of the German persecution of the Jews was made visible and was perceived as particularly, well, appalling. And that triggered a remarkable reaction among the higher ranks of the dignitaries of the Catholic Church. First, they at their assembly, the bishops and archbishops of France at the end of July drafted a kind of resolution addressed to the head of state, Marshal Pétain, where they expressed the fact that they were extremely appalled by the conditions under where the Jews had been herded together and had been deported. But that was still a measure that happened, if you will, behind closed doors. It was not a public protest. But one very significant and maybe even decisive fact was that one of those archbishops, the Archbishop of Toulouse, Monseigneur Saliège, he issued a letter to be read from the pulpit for his archdiocese, and that letter was dispatched under very difficult circumstances to all local churches within the archdiocese. It was read in large parts of the archdiocese from the pulpit. It was even broadcasted by Radio London a couple of weeks later. And that put an enormous political pressure on the Vichy regime because it was crystal clear that all this could only have happened, the deportations and the accompanying appalling circumstances and atrocities, only that could have happened with the consent and the immediate and direct help of French authorities, including the Vichy police, that was actually the institution that made the arrests and had the Jews handed over to their German persecutors.
Are the church leaders responding to their diocese, to the people, or are they leading these calls? Are they the ones who are horrified, or are the churchgoers the ones that are horrified?
Well, certainly both was the case, but as always in similar circumstances, it really depended on a very small group of determined dignitaries of the French Catholic Church, and one was Saliège, the Archbishop of Toulouse, and the other one was the Archbishop Gerlier in Lyon, who at the same time was the highest-ranking Catholic dignitary in the unoccupied zone. The city of Lyon was 1942, still located in the unoccupied zone. And he himself had a conflict with the regional prefect of the region of Lyon, who was himself, the regional prefect, a Vichy authority official. And he had asked one of the Catholic priests to hand him over his authorities, a group of several dozens of Jewish children who had sought and found refuge in a Catholic childcare institution. And that priest refused to do that. And as a result, the regional prefect addressed himself to Gerlier, the archbishop, the cardinal, actually, of Lyon. And Gerlier, in very significant terms, made it crystal clear that in his jurisdiction, the Catholic Church would not do anything in support of the deportation measures imposed by the Germans, allegedly, but executed by the Vichy authorities. So those were the two, if you will, towering figures of the resistance of the Catholic Church against the deportation plan executed by the Vichy authorities, and that marked, if you will, the turn of the tide as far as the implementation of the so-called final solution in France was concerned.
So soon thereafter, or maybe a year or so thereafter, the war begins to turn against Germany, whereas up until about 1943, maybe a little bit earlier, it looks like Germany might win the war. That obviously affects the French calculations. When it begins looking clearer that Germany might lose the war, this is obviously also going to affect French collaboration. What are the French reactions with regards to the deportation measures once news begins to filter through that Germany may not win this war?
Well, the interesting thing is that even earlier, and that was in early September, 1942, so when the Germans had already conquered much of Stalingrad, then the German troops were still marching into the Caucasus, and so the general expectation was that the Germans at least could win the war, even if, of course, that was subject to uncertainty and speculation. But at that stage, if you will, at the peak of German military and political dominance in all over Europe, it was under the pressure of the domestic resistance, head of government, Pierre Laval, who himself approached, again, this very Karl Oberg, after whom the Oberbusquet headquarters was named in the subsequent literature, admittedly, asking for the deceleration of the pace of the deportation because dignitaries, this handful of determined Catholic dignitaries, had articulated their strong protest directly vis-à-vis the head of state, Marshal Pétain, and that he himself, the head of government, Pierre Laval, found himself under the pressure of Pétain, and that was why he asked Oberg to consider a kind of revision of the initially planned deportation scheme. And the, if you will, miracle that happened was that after consultation with no less a man like Heinrich Himmler, so the highest ranking SS official, the head and chief of the SS, after consulting Himmler, Himmler himself gave permission to restrain the deportation to non-French Jews and to decelerate for the time being the rhythm at the pace of the deportation. And that was a sign of the, well, political intelligence, if you will, of both the SS and Pierre Laval himself, because they were probably acting under the assumption that, well, it was a matter of months, maybe, that, well, Germany would be able to enforce its will on the French authority anyway, and it was not worth the effort to risk a political conflict with a collaborating Vichy government over, well, let's say, a couple of thousand deported Jews, more or less. So it was this kind of cynical pragmatism that resulted in the fact that from September on, the pace of deportation of Jews from French soil significantly decreased.
So, do the French authorities continue to play a role up until the very end, till 1944, or do they begin to take a slow step backwards, and do the Germans then sort of sweep in to try and fulfill the final solution and the deportation quotas?
Well, the political will and readiness on the Vichy side to collaborate with the Germans also in the area of their anti-Jewish agenda and the rigid and comprehensive deportation of Jews from French soil, that readiness and inclination decreased as well in the ongoing war. And certainly the turn of the tide, if you will, in military terms, with the German and Italian defeat at El Alamein in late November 1942, with the Allied landing in North Africa, with the destruction of the Sixth Army in Stalingrad, and the turn of the military, or the change of the military situation in favor of the anti-Hitler coalition, that exerted its own impact on the political disposition of the Vichy regime. So anything that compromised the French government in Vichy as a collaborator with the Germans became less and less attractive. And that, of course, also affected the readiness of the Vichy officials, at least, to collaborate in the area of the anti-Jewish persecution as well.
I want to end with a quote, because we're running out of time at the moment, but it's a quote that I think captures your argument perfectly. And I quote, "The persecution of the Jews in France was guided by the ambivalence of the pursuit of power within the power-sharing administration, and the radicalization or containment of persecution depended on whether the key actors on the German and French sides who were competing for power were forced to include the effects of moral norms in their calculations, even though they did not necessarily share these moral norms themselves." Mm-hmm. Now, I have one, hopefully two questions that flows from this. And indeed from the book as a whole. What role do you ascribe to ideology in all of this?
Well, ideology was the necessary but not the sufficient condition. Mm. Without anti-Semitism and without the ideologically motivated determination to wipe out an entire minority from the surface of the earth, that genocide would not have happened. However, it was not a sufficient condition because, the Germans were not able to do it all alone. So the dependence on the human, organizational, economic, and military resources of German-occupied countries was a decisive factor in the implementation of the Holocaust. And the significant and very revealing phenomenon in France is exactly the ambivalence of a power-sharing arrangement, because the power-sharing arrangement implied the mechanism of bargaining and negotiations. In that bargaining process, it depended on the relative gains that were to be made by both sides. But as far as the Vichy side, the French side, was concerned, at a certain point, and that was in June, July 1942, it seemed to be advantageous to make concessions to the Germans also as far as the so-called final solution of the Jewish question was concerned, in terms of making available French police forces and French administrative capacity for the German persecutors. But from a certain point on, and that depended on the domestic support for those persecutory measures, the Vichy authorities were less willing to collaborate also in the so-called final solution of the Jewish question. And that reveals that, on the one hand, it was not necessary to become a collaborator in the persecution of the Jews to be an anti-Semit. And this is much more disturbing than the notion of anti-Semitism and the ideological motivation to be a necessary condition for the persecution. That was not the case. But on the other hand, it also tells us how strong the political impact of morality can be, because it was the original moral impulse that there are things we cannot do to, well, humans, especially not from a Christian perspective. And that was exactly the perspective that had that was articulated by those few high-ranking dignitaries of the Catholic Church. And that demonstrates how fragile complicity can be, complicity in mass crime, and that it is worth every effort to mobilize moral resistance as a precondition for political and decisive resistance against mass crime.
And finally, and this is a kind of a nerdy question, but I'm going to ask it. Recently, I've been reading a book by a guy who I'm sure you know well, William Niskanen, and he talked about what he calls the bureaucrat's maximand, by which he meant that bureaucrats tend to view maximizing their budgets and therefore their authority or power of their departments as their primary function. Seen as the people that you've covered were all bureaucrats of a sort, and that this budget slash power maximizing behavior is typical of most bureaucracies, do you think that a modern day bureaucracy would behave any differently in a similar situation?
Well, quite honestly, I don't think so.
Okay.
If conditions arise that make, from that point of view, collaboration in mass crime and complicity in mass crime, well, if you will, profitable for one's own sake and for one's own authority, why should we imagine a bureaucrats to behave differently than they behaved 70 or 75 years ago? So the decisive point is that without moral impulse, without a sound ethical grounding of what you do as a bureaucrat, everything is possible. And the fact that you always need an example, that you always need leadership for morality to prevail, is also a lesson to be learned from the French case in the implementation of the Holocaust, because that leadership was not displayed by the people in charge in the Vichy government and the Vichy authorities, but it was displayed by just a handful of, high-ranking dignitaries of the Catholic Church. It could have been everybody, but the fact And that's one part of the irony of the story, that the Catholic Church belonged to the political pillars and supporters of the very Vichy regime, made it so influential once it took a different stance in as far as the persecution of the Jews was concerned. And the tipping point, like I said, was the summer of 1942. And the change, of course, the Catholic dignitaries basically imposed, if you will, on the Vichy government as far as the pace of the deportation of the Jews from French soil was concerned.
Well, it's getting dark and you have to go and get a taxi. So the book is called Persecution and Rescue, The Politics of the Final Solution in France, 1940 to 1944, published last year with the University of Michigan Press. If you want to read the original in German, it's called Macht und Moral, which is a more revealing title perhaps. Die Endlösung der Judenfrage in Frankreich, 1940 bis 1944, published with Konstanz University Press. Honestly, I can't emphasize enough how highly I recommend this book. It's both the most convincing and perhaps also, sadly, the most frightening analysis of the Holocaust that I've ever read. So get out there, buy it, read it. Professor Seibel, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, and thank you very much.